WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. We learned some 15,000 IRS employees have been identified for possible termination as early as next week. As the White House seeks to find cost savings across the government, the employees are said to be on probationary status with limited tenure. Applause in Tel Aviv's hostage square this morning when video screens showed the release of three hostages by Hamas militants and then handed over to Red Cross officials in Gaza, one of them an American.
The reaction here is certainly one of relief. It has been 497 agonizing days for these families and for the friends of the hostages. And so for this moment to unfold here is certainly a moment of relief and a brief moment of happiness.
ABC's Marcus Moore in Hostage Square. The Justice Department formally asked a New York federal judge Friday evening to drop the public corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Seven top prosecutors resigned in protest over the dismissal this week. This is ABC News. New concern over the health of Pope Francis, the 88-year-old pontiff spending the night in a hospital in Rome. The Vatican saying he's being treated for bronchitis. ABC News Chief International Correspondent James Longman is in Vatican City.
They say that he has had a peaceful night. He now no longer has a fever. The results, there were a number of tests that were performed on him throughout the day, and his results apparently are improving. He has spent the day in rest, at prayer, and he's been reading as well. The 10th floor of the Gemelli Hospital, there's kind of a suite of rooms there. It's basically an apartment. There's his room, there's a living area, there's a chapel as well. So perhaps he spent time there.
An active volcano near Alaska's most populated city could be on the brink of eruption, according to scientists who are constantly monitoring the potential threat. Signs of unrest at Mount Spur, located in the Aleutian Arc in southern Alaska, about 75 miles west of Anchorage, have increased over the past 10 months. Dave Packer, ABC News.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. Believe it or not, it is once again time for Wisconsinites to head to the polls and vote. I know, we all have a bit of election fatigue after 2024, but the spring election primary is coming up on Tuesday, February 18th. One race that will be on every ballot statewide for the spring primary is for state superintendent. Incumbent Jill Underley is seeking another term, and two candidates are challenging her. Jeff Wright, superintendent for Sauk Prairie Schools, and Brittany Kinzer, an education consultant and former charter school executive. Kinzer's candidacy, in particular, is gaining steam. Her campaign reported raising more than $500,000, far more than what Underley or Wright have brought in. With that type of financial support, this could prove to be a more competitive race for state superintendent than what we've seen in quite some time. This is becoming a real race to watch.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WISS.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Conservation groups are criticizing the Trump administration's new review of all oil, gas, and mining on public lands. Suzanne Potter reports.
New U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has ordered a 15-day internal review of these sites, which conservation groups warn could be a first step toward altering their boundaries to allow fossil fuel and mineral extraction. And yet, Daniel Hart with the National Parks Conservation Association says this would do little to address the energy emergency recently declared by President Donald Trump.
The timeline from starting a lease sale until oil and gas is pumping and then refined and into the markets is a long time. It would not immediately do anything to lower gas prices.
In the past, Carrizo Plain National Monument on the Central Coast has been eyed for oil and gas development. Other national monuments in California whose boundaries could be reevaluated include the two newest, Chuckwalla and Satitla National Monuments, along with 13 others across the state. Hart says these public lands are crucial for wildlife habitat and recreation, and he points out they pump billions of dollars into the outdoor economy.
They protect both natural and cultural resources. They are a great place for our shared histories, but also the public benefit. They support the outdoor recreation economy, especially in rural states.
Across the U.S., 24 million acres of public land are already leased to oil and gas companies for fossil fuel extraction, with over 12 million acres under active drilling. The NPCA says key monuments that risk losing protections include Devil's Tower in Wyoming and the Dinosaur and Hovensweep National Monuments in Utah. I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Winter weather advisories continue with flurries and snow showers and an inch or two of accumulation with a high in the low 30s. Still some flurries and snow showers tonight, low in the mid-teens. Gradually clearing for tomorrow, but colder, high near 20. Currently it's 26.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On Monday's show, Kristen Ambos with Point Mortgage and Paul Vanden Plus with Wonderfully Wisconsin.
Plus, local author Stacy Ryan joins us again. Her book series is finally out.
Join us.
This is the Fox Valley's Real News and Great Conversation, WISS.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey there, political orphans, swing voters, independents, that whole gang. Welcome to special edition of Lost in the Middle. We're going to do a countdown between the middle of September and work our way up till Election Day. And we've sort of switched out the format. This won't be storytelling the way we do things. But instead, what I'm doing is talking to some of the smartest political podcast hosts in the country. But before we go there, I want to tell you a quick story. When I left Congress, it was sort of running up to the 2000 election. And I got a call from a good friend of mine named Brady Williamson. And Brady said, I've got an idea for you. What's that? He said, let's try to get a political debate in Madison because it would be interesting in the 2000 election. And Brady had worked for the Clintons for years and was a Democratic operative. And I said, let's rock and roll. So we reached out to what was then called the Political Debate Commission, which everybody thought was an official arm of the federal government. But instead, it was just a cozy room between a longstanding Republican and a longstanding Democratic operative who figured out a way to make money on this. And the deal was you had to raise $500,000 because the presidential debate is a television operation. And so the first thing we had to do was raise, I don't know, I think it was $200,000 to show that we were serious, which actually was much easier than we thought it would be. We had a couple of large Madison businesses step forward, and then some foundations locally, and then we're ready to rock and roll. And then out come the folks who actually scout the presidential debate. And so we wandered around Madison looking for venues. And so the whole Madison community was geeked about the idea. And then they wanted to show off the new Madison Civic Center, which had been designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. And they walked in the room, and we probably spent maybe 3.5 minutes in it, because if you've ever seen anything designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, it may be brilliant, but it's weird. And every section we looked, there was a column or a weird thing. Walked out of that, then went to the old Oscar Mayer Theater. Yes, Madison was the home of Oscar Mayer Wieners and the Wienermobile. And they liked that a lot, but it was a really cool old building and would have great angles to look down on the audience and looked very ornate and very rich. And then it turned out by the time they built out the stage downstairs, there'd be no time for sitting. So that went out the window. And so we ended up with the Madison Expo Center, which was just basically a big box. So it was a weird year because the Olympics were that fall and the World Series was really late. And so they decided at the end of the day, they're going to have to do all of the four debates, three presidential and one vice presidential, in a very compressed time frame. So we're sitting around like the NFL draft waiting for the phone to ring, and they pick up the phone and say, Brady, Scott, we've got some great news for you. Okay, we want you to host the vice presidential debate. It's like, who the hell watches the vice presidential debate, much less trying to raise $500,000 to stage it? And as we're looking through sort of depressed glasses at one another, they say, here's the date. And they pick a weekend in October in a great Wisconsin story that's not a punchline. It was the World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. We were off the hook. You could not find a hotel room because people with trailers and pickup trucks were driving their prize Holsteins to Dane County, Wisconsin to show them off. So our prize for doing that was actually we got tickets to go to the presidential debate in Boston. Al Gore and George Bush. The highlight of the night for me personally was that Christy Brinkley sat in front of me with purple, sort of eggplant colored leather pants. And let's just say it was not a particularly good look. But the defining moment of the debate was Al Gore doing this every time George Bush started to answer a question. And it's literally graded by historians as one of the 10 worst debate moments in U.S. presidential history. So we never ended up with the debate here, but we just all watched the debate. And I want to turn around to my guest, Andrew Heaton, who's actually calling us in from Scotland, from a phone booth in a men's businessman club, I take it is, Andrew?
I'm at the Royal Scots Club, which is just a nice, stuffy club that has allowed me to become a member. I like to work out of here, and being a humble boy from Oklahoma, I find it endlessly funny to talk to old British men in three-piece suits. So I come to Scotland to avoid the Texan weather for about a month a year, and then I work out of here.
Well, you can tell by the early introduction. So Andrew actually hosts a podcast much aligned with us called The Political Orphanage. So that means my political orphans actually live in his political orphanage when they turn into his podcast, which is terrific. Mm-hmm. He's been a stand-up comedian. He's performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. He's written a bunch of books, including one that's called Laughter is Better Than Communism. And he actually opened up for William Shatner, who said, wow, that Andrew guy, he's pretty funny. But the cool thing is, and most people won't know this, and I actually know this because my youngest son spent some time in comedy, is you performed with Upright Citizens Brigade in L.A., which is sort of the West Coast version of Second City, who don't know it. So,
yeah, it was New York, but yes, the UCB, it had outposts on both coasts, and I got improvisational training from the good people at UCB. I have a certificate saying I'm funny. I have it on my wall. UCB is a fish. I'm licensed to be funny by UCB.
That's terrific. And then worked on the Hill for Tim Holden, who's an old buddy of mine, who was a Democrat from Pittsburgh. We used to play in the congressional baseball game together. And Tim actually had one of the worst moments I've ever seen because he and Bill Jefferson, another Democrat from Louisiana, who later on got sentenced to prison for racketeering, but that's an entirely different story. Tim was at first base. Bill was at catcher. Somebody popped up in the middle of the first base and home plate, and they collided head on. And Steve Largent was playing with us, former NFL football player, who said that was the ugliest collision I've ever seen, worse than anything I'd ever seen in the NFL. And they both, Tim got gashes, Jefferson got teeth knocked out, everything in the world. So now that I've completely wasted everybody's time for 8 or 9 minutes with a story that went nowhere, let's talk about your impressions of the debate. Does it really matter? Did it really change anybody's mind?
Yes, I think they do. So I was very skeptical of the debates up until about 3 months ago. I'm one of these people that is angry at the what had been the Presidential Commission on Debates, because it seemed to me that they were intentionally icing out any third party candidates that would come in, and I was ruffled about that. I was angry that Gary Johnson had approached whatever metric they needed, and then they immediately put it up to 10% in order to ice him out, and was taking the rather cynical view of, like, look, everyone in America has made up their mind about Biden and Trump. This is before Biden dropped out. No one needs any additional information. It's not as if Trump is some sort of coy, opaque figure that we don't know a lot about. And I have changed my tune on that completely. I watched the debate between Biden and Trump, and I had been likewise kind of skeptical about the whole Biden mental acuity thing, because that sounded to me like kind of a made up Republican talking point. And then I, like much of the rest of the country, watched the president's brains drain out of his ears like motor oil and went, oh, this the apparently they were right about this. We have been gaslit, America. So I thought that the debate did a really good public service at that point. The most recent, so for that reason, I think the debates are good, just because they do allow you to see if somebody's truly crazy or not. I don't think that they're particularly salient for policy discussions, and the latest debate was not salient for policy discussions, but I think that they could be useful in that regard. In terms of pushing people to vote in a particular direction, yes. My understanding is that last-minute voters tend to be disproportionately affected by the personalities they see on display at the debates, and by bombardments of advertising that get them the last couple of weeks. So for most people that are plugged into politics, and I would imagine that that's the bulk of your audience, they probably have their own internal compass that they're using and some kind of metric they're using to make decisions in terms of who they're going to vote for that involves ideology and policy goals and character or something to that effect, right? I think there is a group of people, and they're ultimately who's going to determine this election, which are not nearly that attuned to politics. And so for them, they're running a lot of this off of gut feelings and vibes. And in that capacity, I think it's going to really benefit Kamala Harris, because my personal suspicion is I'm telling all the Scots while I'm here, I'm putting it 60-40 on Kamala Trump. I think she's going to take it. It's going to be razor thin, but I think that she's probably going to take it. And my rationale for this is that I think the last minute voters, they're not reliably Republican or Democrat, are going to basically go, I don't know, I associate Trump with old screamy guys. I don't like that. Let's give this new lady a try. She seems sane. And Kamala did a good job of appearing sane and reasonably normal for the course of the debate. And so I think that vibe will work to her advantage.
So who's left that hasn't made up their mind?
I think it is the swing, like the truly swing voters, right? So like I'm an independent, and I'm a big critic of the two-party system, and I will kind of join people in breathlessly talking about how wonderful it is that independents are gaining traction and they're now the largest voting bloc. They're larger than Republicans or Democrats. But when you really look at it, the majority of independents, probably about 80%, are reliably Republican or Democratic voters, but they just really don't like the party. And so it's almost like a protest that they're registering as an independent, but they're going to vote Republican or Democrat. That leaves about 20%. And half of those people, I think, are like me, where we are very plugged in, but we have our own aberrant, weird Rorschach test that we're applying to American politics, which means we're not permanently in the pocket of either camp. But I think that there's another group of people that for them, they're living their lives and they're thinking about work and thinking about their kids. And they're not really thinking about politics. And so they're a lot more affected by how they would judge a used car salesman, which is like, does this person seem honest? Does this person seem like they're going to be the person who's going to sell me the right car? Are they going to swindle me? Can they get things done? Are they going to be a good boss? They're going with personality attributes to a great extent. And I think those are the kind of swing voters that will be swayed by the debate.
I think for folks who are political junkies, it's hard to understand. I mean, I keep running into people who say there can't be any undecided voters. They can't be, but there are. And I think people have a hard time comprehending that. And, you know, the interesting thing is if you talk to political consultants, I mean, I spent a bunch of time arguing with Mike Murphy over this idea, whether they're independents or really they're just closet Republicans or closet Democrats. If you talk to the folks at Arizona State and Tom Riley, who runs the only political science department in the country, which has a specific study of independent voters, he'll tell you there are a significant chunk. And if you look, you can see it for yourself. If you look at the vote totals in 2012, they went dramatically for Obama. Then they turned around and shifted to Trump. And then in 20, they shifted around and voted for Clinton. So I do think there's a group that is permanently disengaged with either of the major political parties. But we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Andrew, I want to talk to you about why I think your analysis is wrong on the debate, because I want to tell you the two issues that I think are trouble for Harris.
Great.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that protects property owners and their interests. Did you know that in 10 states and Washington, D.C., the government can take more than what it is owed in property taxes in the instance of a foreclosure? From 2014 to 2021, 8,600 homes and more than $780 million in savings were lost to this practice known as home equity theft. We are working to end home equity theft everywhere it remains on the books. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to join the effort to protect property rights.
The Todd Alba Show.
Pat Kreitlow, all your time in the media, television, radio, what have you, what was one or two of the oddest things that people were complaining about?
As a TV anchor, your hair.
You have some of the finest hair around. How could anybody criticize your hair?
Oh, well, because a consultant forced me to change it.
Were there focus groups?
I'm not aware of any focus groups other than the audience, which universally hated it. It was a bowl haircut.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local civic media radio station and on the app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Dr. Susan Webb Yackey, what advice would you give everyone who has an opportunity to engage in conversation with folks, and sometimes we don't think alike?
One state of mind is to be curious about it. How did you come to that point of view? And the other is humility. This idea that we don't have all the answers.
The
Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
Well, welcome back, and we're just beginning our conversation with Andrew Heaton, who's a great political podcast host on a podcast called The Political Orphanage. He's done a lot of comedy work. He's written a whole bunch, and he and I think share a lot of sort of similar framing of how we think this election goes. So if
I'll even add to that, Scott. You were kind enough to come on my program, The Political Orphanage, and you think so similar to me that it kind of freaked me out. And at one point, I began postulating that you might be me from the future who'd come back to talk to me in the past. It was very unnerving.
Well, we can probably sell that as a pilot to CBS or somebody.
Yeah, right? I like that. Time-traveling pundits, yeah.
So there's sort of two framing things you have to do in elections. Well, there's actually three. I mean, if you and I are running against each other, I have to define you. Right. And then I have to define who I am. And then the third thing is you have to figure out what issues you're running on. And sometimes that's good for you and sometimes it's bad for you. And I think the problem for Harris is going to be as we get closer to those undecided voters, it's people who weren't thrilled with what the economy's looked like the last 4 years. And I think I'm not a fan of the former president, as anybody who listens to this show knows. But I just think at the end of the day, it's people who are still worried about the cost of gas, the cost of bread, about taking their kids to McDonald's, about canceling a summer vacation. I think those folks are going to look and say, wow, Trump's really a strange guy, but it was better than he was president.
That could be the case. I mean, I think one of the other things that Kamala is doing that is a strategic decision that may or may not benefit her is she's intentionally trying to remain a kind of Schrodinger's candidate, where when she ran in 2020, as Trump has pointed out multiple times, she ran as a very progressive candidate and then flamed out before Iowa, whereas now she has tacked much more to the center and is emphatically in favor of fracking and all of the things that more centrist Democrats would favor. When I was at the Democratic National Convention last month, it was lots of really good vibes. Everybody was really happy. The AOC wing of the party was really happy with her. They were thrilled with Tim Walz. The Obama free trade wing of the party liked her. Everybody liked her. And so she had a kind of internal rationale not to cease being a quantum candidate and really define herself, because she'd alienate one wing or the other. And she's kind of started doing that because she's released some policy papers, so you can now actually get a feel for what she's allegedly going to do. But I think she's kind of playing that same card at the general election. And I do think it'll help in terms of the people that are just going off of vibes, because they're just going to see a fresh face and go, I don't know, let's try a new one. In terms of the economy, you might have a point there. The polls indicate that people associate Trump with a better economy. I have a lot of qualms with that, in that I am very much in favor of free trade and think tariffs are stupid. So I have a lot of problems with his economic model. But that seems to be earned or unearned, the benefit that he gets. He gets like a +5 in economy.
Yeah, which is interesting. And then the other issue, which isn't hot for her either, is immigration. And so that's why I think she did a marvelous job in the debate making the case for the case against the Republicans on abortion, which I thought was really the high moment of the campaign. And now let's talk about the low moment of the campaign. People eating pets and casseroles in Ohio, which seems You know, I appreciate the fact that CBS fact checked it, but did you really need to fact check that?
That, all right. There's two ways we can look at American politics going forward. We can either be very sad or we can find it very funny. I've decided to find it very funny. I have decided to treat this more like a sitcom than a Black Mirror episode. And looking at it with the sitcom analysis, I thought that whole moment was very funny because the precipitating moment to that was Kamala obviously baiting Donald Trump in a way that you could see from a million miles away, where I don't remember what the actual thing they were discussing was. Probably it wasn't the border. It was something else, the economy. I don't know. And she went, I invite people to watch a Trump rally. Because what you will find is that people leave early because they find it boring and exhausting. And I saw that and I was like, there's no, like any other political candidate would go, well, that's just, you know, like that's not really pertinent to what we're discussing here. But Trump could not, like, no, in a million years, Trump cannot let that go. So he immediately had to come back with, like, our rallies are amazing. And then after that, he was so addled, that's when he stepped into the they're eating cats line. And yes, I think the weird analysis that I have been seeing of the debate is where a lot of the pro-Trump people are saying, you know, the moderators were fact-checking Trump much harder than Kamala Harris. And I'm like, yes, I agree on that. However, the whole they shouldn't have fact-checked him as hard on immigrants are eating cats line, to me, is just not a really good strategy. I'm saying, like, if only they hadn't fact-checked him on that, he'd be doing okay. I don't think so.
But the flip side of that, and I thought CBS really, or excuse me, ABC did a pretty good job and tried to balance it. And I think the mics being muted, while it didn't make for as much street theater, at least you got to hear what people were saying rather than, it's my turn to talk. But I was troubled by the fact they asked one question about her policy flips. She answered it on fracking without pushing her. And then they never went back to the other stuff, which I thought led her off far too easy. And that bothers me. I mean, I generally, as somebody who spent 14 years in journalism, still spend lots of time on the journalism board at Northwestern University. I find a lot of the coverage, unfortunately, skewed. Do you agree with me on that?
Wholeheartedly, yes. I know you played board games when you were in high school, Scott. Did you ever play Dungeons and Dragons by chance?
I wasn't that weird. I played Risk and weird games in a couple
nice
of
times. I was a big Risk guy. In D&D, you've got character attributes, and you'll roll your character attributes of how strong you are and how smart you are. And in American politics, Republicans just kind of get a +5 automatically on the economy, and they get a +5 on defense. And Democrats just get like a +10 on integrity from the media. Like they just you by virtue of being a Democrat, you automatically get kind of a soft glove there. I didn't think that the moderators were in the can for Kamala. But I agree. I think generally speaking that the people that are running those debates are probably trying to be even handed. But they're personally very invested in Trump losing. And as a result, they're overzealous in fact-checking him. And I think that goes back to, like, Romney and Obama. I don't disagree with that. I think that the media scrutiny is a lot harder. It's arguably one of the benefits of Trump, because I'm also not a Trump guy, but one of the benefits of Trump is that I think he actually compels journalists to do their job. When Biden, like, I as a, like, turn-your-head-and-squint-level journalist, like, I could technically be a journalist depending on how you're looking at me. I view myself as in a positive adversarial relationship with politicians, the same way that a prosecutor is in a positive adversarial relationship with a defense attorney. There's an emergent order that comes out of the system by virtue of both parties squaring off against each other. So I don't want to take the position of just liking people in power from one side and disliking the other. I think we should always be putting pressure on them. And when Biden won the last election, the fact checker for CNN just went on vacation. And I looked at that and was like, but this is the exact time that you should be fact checking the incoming guy when he's like, this is the time to really. But the attitude was the threat is over. The threat is over. We can all go home now. And yes, I think that becomes a big problem with legacy media.
Well, and I think there's a big problem with legacy media, too, in terms of diversity. Right. You saw the big kerfuffle when one of the NPR editors quit, because when he did a check of where his fellow reporters were registered, you can do that at the political rolls in Virginia and Washington and Maryland, because it's all a public record. There were no Republicans. It was 93-0. And famously, you know, the in the study that was done by Nate Silver, it was only 6% of journalists self-identified as Republicans. So not that they're making things up, but it would help if they had a little different perspective and didn't think the world would be solved by five more government programs.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for Matt and Air on Air.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. We learned some 15,000 IRS employees have been identified for possible termination as early as next week. As the White House seeks to find cost savings across the government, the employees are said to be on probationary status with limited tenure. Applause in Tel Aviv's hostage square this morning when video screen showed the release of three hostages by Hamas militants and then handed over to Red Cross officials in Gaza, one of them an American.
The reaction here is certainly one of relief. It has been 497 agonizing days for these families and for the friends of the hostages. And so for this moment to unfold here, certainly a moment of relief and a brief moment of happiness.
ABC's Marcus Moore in Hostage Square. The Justice Department formally asked a New York federal judge Friday evening to drop the public corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Seven top prosecutors resigned in protest over the dismissal this week. This is ABC News.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Brandon Woodruff back on the mound. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. At Brewers spring training in Arizona, pitcher Brandon Woodruff throwing 20 pitches for the first time to batters after having surgery on his shoulder back in October of 2023. How did it feel?
Felt great. When you can kind of break down, obviously I was nervous, jittery. Like, I mean, it's the first time in a year and a half, but I felt good. I think it went a lot better than I expected to, which was I needed this. I needed to face hitters. I needed Bowers, and I needed William to step in the box. You know what I mean? Like, you got a all-star steps in the box, the first hitter you've seen in a year and a half. I mean, you can't help but get a little adrenaline going. So it was good for me. Got some good feedback, and now it's just recover. Like, go recover and get used to doing this again.
NBA All-Star Weekend, the Bucks' Marcus Johnson named a finalist for the Basketball Hall of Fame. The final vote to be announced in April. Bucks head coach Doc Rivers did not make the cut. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Winter weather advisories continue with flurries and snow showers and an inch or two of accumulation with a high in the low 30s. Still some flurries and snow showers tonight, low in the mid-teens. Gradually clearing for tomorrow, but colder, high near 20.
Currently it's 26.
Governor Tony Evers is set to share his budget address to the state on Tuesday, February 18th at 7 p.m. You can count on the Civic Media team to have it covered for you here, live.
And when the polls close, you'll also hear your primary election results from the races important to you and your family.
Live coverage of the elections in your area and the budget address, Tuesday, February 18th at 7 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. While attacks on democracy norms ensue in Washington, state legislatures have also been busy. We have updates from Utah, Kansas, Indiana, and the contested North Carolina Supreme Court race. Voting Rights Lab reports that the Utah House is considering HB 300, which forces mail-in ballot users to deliver their ballot not by mail, but by hand to an official polling place where an ID can be presented. The elderly, disabled, and other voters for whom returning by mail is their only option would need to seek special permission. HB 332 would withdraw Utah from the Cooperative Electronic Registration Data Center, the subject of far-right conspiracy theories. The Kansas Senate passed SB 4, which requires receipt of mail-in ballots by 7 p.m. Election Day to count, rather than the current 3 days after. An Indiana Senate committee advanced SB 284, shortening early in-person voting from 28 days to 14 days, ending at noon the day before Election Day. The full Senate passed SB 10, ending use of school-issued student identification as ID for voting. In North Carolina, a district court judge dismissed a claim by a state Supreme Court candidate that in a race he lost by 734 votes, as many as 65,000 voters were ineligible. A federal appeals court may revisit it. We've linked the Voting Rights Lab tracker at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
I'm Charlie Behrens. This is Civic Media, and here's my conversation with Lawrence Pratt.
And so anything that's floating gets carried towards the center. But it doesn't actually collect right in the very center. I mean, it will collect in a pretty big region. I mean, something that's about twice the size of Texas.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so you find, you find larger concentrations of floating plastic and microplastics at the surface of those gyres. It's not, Charlie, like you would go out in a boat there and you just see something that looks like a garbage dump.
Right, right.
There might be places where you see floating bottles and so on, but it's not like, it's not like this awful place. It's just more if you actually measure what's out there, you count the number of plastics, you just find greater concentrations there than you do in other parts of the open ocean.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So yeah. A lot of the microplastic in the ocean is going toward these gyres in the various oceans. That's right. On the surface.
Yeah.
What about under the surface?
Yeah, that's a big mystery. So we know that there's, a lot of the heavier plastics, they just sink to the bottom and they get into the sediment, and that's been well measured. Even in the deepest trenches in the ocean, you can find microplastics in the sediment. But there's some plastics that they have a density that's fairly close to seawater, and so they might be just slightly buoyant or just a little bit heavier than the water. And so they can be suspended for long periods of time in the ocean. And those are the ones that I'm interested in. But when you actually go out and look for them, you can find very, very small numbers. And then you can go to another spot where you find really large numbers. So, for example, one survey that I saw took a bunch of water samples at like, I'll say 1,000 meters depth, and they hardly found any microplastics. But then I talked to another team from Japan, and they took some samples from underneath the Kuroshio, which is it's a big current there. And at about the same depth, they were finding like 1,000 particles for every cubic meter. So we just have samples here and there. Very sparse samples, and so we really don't know a lot about the subsurface distributions of microplastics. But we do know that there are certain places where you find a lot of them.
And we should step back and say that how do these microplastics get into the ocean to begin with? Like, what is a microplastic? Where does it come from? And what can people who are interested in just stopping their part in creating more microplastics, what can they do?
Yeah, so a lot of microplastics, first of all, microplastics are small bits of plastic, kind of the largest size that we think of as a microplastic is 5 millimeters, okay? So a millimeter is what? It's about the size of the thickness of your toenail, something like that. So the larger ones we can see, they range in size all the way down to, to a micron, which is like 1/1000th of a millimeter. So those are ones we can't see. And then you have ones that are even smaller than that. Those are the nanoplastics that you talk about. Those are hard to find. We don't know too much about those. And where do they come from? There's a lot of different sources. So they can come from the disintegration of things like plastic bottles and plastic bags. You think about a bag that blows into a stream or something like that, and then it travels down that stream. It's subject to mechanical stresses from the water and the waves. It's being hit by ultraviolet sunlight. And so it can slowly break up into small pieces. Or you can take, like a plastic container. I went to the hardware store the other day, and I was looking at tools, and I saw there were some wrenches there they came in these plastic containers.
Dude, nothing pisses me off more when you have a pipe wrench wrapped in plastic. You know, like it's a pipe wrench. I think it's going to be fine.
You know? And then you take it home and you try to cut into it with your scissors, and it's hard and brittle. And even when you're cutting into it, you're creating a lot of little tiny plastic shards. Those are microplastics.
That's amazing to me. The crap people wrap in plastic. Like I got some knives, like a knife block, and every single knife they individually wrap like the handle in plastic. I get if you wrap the blade, you want to protect it with some, I don't know. I feel like cardboard would be a lot easier than but just the amount of unnecessary plastic stuff that you order. Like you get a shirt and it's in a plastic bag. Why? You know, I don't know. I'm on my soapbox now, but I'm glad you brought that up at the hardware store. Of all things, I don't need wrapped in plastic. It's a friggin' wrench, you know?
Yeah, right. And then there's fabrics. There's, like fleece jackets, you know, and I'm as guilty as anyone at wearing those fleece jackets. They're, you know, they're comfortable. They're great. But they do shed a lot of little microplastic fibers when you put them in the washing machine, and that stuff, you know, it's gonna make it into your municipal wastewater treatment plant, and you know, some of it will get filtered out probably, and some won't, and so it'll end up in a stream and eventually into the ocean.
That's really interesting. I don't think a lot of people know that. So, what kind of clothes would have microplastics in them, and are some clothes worse at shedding microplastics than others?
Yeah, so the plastic is the PET, you probably heard of, which is a type of polyethylene, and so these kind of sweaters or zip down jackets are made from that. It's polyester. And if you look closely at it, you can see that there's a lot of tiny little fibers there. And that's basically a type of plastic.
That's on all kinds of like is spandex. There's a lot of plastic in the clothes, but do some come off more in the wash? Like if you wash them cold or something, does that help? Is it the heat that releases them, or just they just release all the time?
I think it's probably just the mechanical stress of being in a washing machine being turned around that turns them loose. There was one of the companies that makes these, to their credit, did some experiments where they put one of these things in a washing machine for 24 hours. The reasoning being that that's about the time that an average jacket is going to spend in a washing machine over its lifetime. You know, maybe you wash it once a year or something like that for 12 years. Mm-hmm. So they did that, and then they counted the number of microfibers that got shed from that jacket, and it was in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So just don't wash your clothes.
Well, that's, and then, you know, you probably have to be careful of how to dispose of them too.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you can't, they're just a problem anywhere they are. How do you dispose of them? Do you have any ideas on that?
We have, every once in a while in our town, there's a collection of certain types of plastics that you can't just put in our regular recycle. Like, recently there was a styrofoam. You could go to the high school and leave your styrofoam stuff there. And there's also collections like that specifically for fabrics too. So you can be on the lookout for those. If you're wherever you live, if they do that, you can take advantage.
Very interesting. Yeah. I mean, you do as much as you personally can. It's probably not going to stop this is real tragedy of the commons. Like, yeah, maybe I can be looking out for that styrofoam recycling or that fleece jacket recycling. But when most people don't even know that that's what's happening with fleece jackets, you can see real quick. Like, what role do you think sort of the companies that are making those things should have in like telling people about that and also kind of cleaning up what has been put out in the environment?
Yeah, well, I don't want to get too down on the companies. I think it might have been Patagonia that did this experiment, and so that's to their credit, and I think these companies are right now, given the the interest, you know, of the health risks of microplastics are probably thinking about developing new fabrics, maybe fabrics that don't actually shed the microplastics or are based on some other material. But, you know, in general, I think we can do a lot just with trying to avoid single use plastics, you know.
Oh, like plastic straws?
Plastic straws, plastic cups, those styrofoam plastic cups that, you know, you go down, you know, if you work in an office, you go down to the coffee machine and they have those styrofoam plastic cups. Typically, those things just get thrown away after one use.
Yeah.
Plastic bags, you know, you can reuse plastic bags many, many times.
So eliminate the single-use plastics. That's really good. What about, is there any way to kind of filter out, like, let's say with the washing machine, you know, and you know the way kind of water works and, you know, can the filter go in the washing machine since it's hard to filter once it's in the ocean? You have to worry about all those other things. But is there a filter that you could put in the washing machine itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I have no idea.
You ever think about like inventing one of those things or like how would you even go about doing it? You know, or is that not really in your specialty?
That's not my wheelhouse. But, you know, if there's a lot of inventors out there, you know, I could see developing something like that. And then maybe, you take it on Shark Tank and get some funding for it.
There you go. Yeah. Mark Cuban, throw $1 million for 500% of the company and then sold, you know. What is it in your studying of the microplastics and nanoplastics in the water system? What are you really like? What's kind of your holy grail? What are you really hoping to figure out? What gets you really excited about it?
So I would like to be able to tell people where in the ocean, the whole three-dimensional ocean, where microplastics are collecting.
Because once you know where they're collecting, then you can go get them, I guess.
That's right, yeah. And I'd also like to be able to tell people where the plastics are actually going. That's part of the story, too. So, you know, there's the estimates of microplastics that are getting into the ocean every year are something like 5 million tons to 12 million tons. So just lots of plastics. But when you go out and you measure or you estimate how much of that stuff is floating at the surface, it's a very small percentage of that. So where is the rest going?
Mm.
And so, you know, there's kind of a budget there. We'd like to figure out, you know, how much is going in, how much is staying in, how much is going, where is it going, how much is washing up on beaches, how much is going into the sediment. Of the stuff that's going into sediment, you know, is it possible that any of that can get resuspended? You know, questions like that.
It's kind of with the ocean being so big, it's how deep is the deepest part of the ocean? Do we know?
So the deepest part is about 10 kilometers, which is about 35,000 feet.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Man.
And they found microplastics down there. So that's in the Challenger Trench, I believe. And so some of those really deep trenches in the Western Pacific, they found microplastics at the bottom of those trenches.
So we know they're getting all the way down there, huh?
Yeah.
And sink. That's crazy. Yeah. What do you think about people who say there's aliens in the ocean? You think we got any motherships down there?
Well, if you can show me some evidence, I'll consider it. I haven't seen any evidence yet.
Okay. I'm just throwing everything at you, just seeing what we can do here.
Yeah.
What is the weirdest thing you've ever found about the ocean?
The weirdest thing, I'm not sure it's the weirdest thing, but the thing that really kind of got my attention is that about half of the oxygen that we breathe actually comes from the ocean.
Really?
Yes.
And how do we get that from the ocean?
So the ocean at the surface has phytoplankton, which are these small organisms that use photosynthesis. And so they're using carbon and they're releasing oxygen just like trees.
Oh, wow.
And as it turns out, quite a bit of oxygen.
Holy smokes. Yeah, I didn't know that either. That's crazy.
Yeah.
How much impact is climate change having on our oceans right now?
Well, so our oceans, our oceans actually absorb a fair amount of the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere. I'm going to say something around 30%. And that's because carbon dioxide can dissolve in water. And then, you know, that carbon that gets in to the ocean gets used, you know, as part of what we call the carbon cycle. So there's organisms that use it. And sometimes those, and so it becomes part of the food chain. And then those organisms will, you know, they'll die or they'll poop it out and it'll sink down to the bottom and become part of the sediment. So, so a lot of the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere actually gets into the ocean. And, but the other thing is that that actually makes the ocean more acidic.
And then that's when you get the, when you see those coral bleachings. And so then the coral gets bleached. So like this all is, it's kind of very complicated. It's really not that complicated, but for your average person who's just scrolling on their phone all day, what are like the big things that, that you think like you should care about this? Why? So the ocean takes in all, it becomes more acidic. The coral reefs get bleached. We hear that happens, but then what does that mean for your average person?
Yeah. So, for your average person that loves coral reefs, that's a big red flag, right? Because a lot of the coral reefs have been bleached. You know, you look at the Great Barrier Reef and that's been bleached. And that's also, you know, a function of the water getting warmer too, which is another consequence of atmospheric warming. And then of course the, when the water gets more acidic, it makes it harder for shellfish to grow shells. And so, you know, it impacts, you know, the food that we get from the ocean.
So basically it like messes the whole food system up because like if shellfish have less hard shells, then I mean, that not only impacts our enjoyment of those fish, but it also probably makes that species more susceptible. Couldn't that collapse the whole food chain of the ocean?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of taking me out of my realm. But yeah, that's what, you know, in general, that's what people are worried about. Another thing that people could think about is, you know, the effects of sea level rise. And about half of sea level rise is actually just due to the thermal expansion of the ocean. So the water gets warmer and it expands a little bit. That causes sea level to rise. And so there's places in the Pacific that are being lost, you know, beautiful coral atolls that are probably going to be lost within the next 50 years. There's an island nation called Kiribati in the Pacific, which includes Christmas Island and about 30 other atolls. And, you know, the highest elevations of these places are maybe 6, 8, 10 feet above sea level. And so they can't really tolerate much sea level rise. And I've been to these places. I love to go bone fishing. So I've been fishing for bonefish on Christmas Island a bunch of times. And now I kind of have to face the prospect that it might not, you know, might not even be there, you know, by the end of the century. And it's just an incredibly beautiful place. It's got palm trees, you know, and beautiful flats that you, and lots of marine life. And so those places are going away. The government of Kiribati has even purchased land on Fiji, which is a more mountainous island. And, you know, they're planning for the, you know, the populations on those islands to eventually move there.
Wow. Yeah, that's and then the Maldives, that's another one, right? Where these are like the modern day Atlantises. And well, then so they are already planning on relocating their people because of sea level rise. What about like Florida? You know, you always see the hurricanes picking up intensity. You see more flooding. What does that have to do with climate change and increased ocean temperature?
Yeah, well, of course, the hurricanes kind of feed on heat that they get from the oceans. And so as the oceans warm, you know, the hurricanes could potentially get more powerful. And they can, and it's complicated too. I mean, they might get started at higher latitude than they do now. The hydrological cycle increases as the planet warms. So there's more rainfall, more evaporation, more water cycling through the atmosphere. And so, you know, the expectations is that the hurricanes are going to get stronger. I'm not sure about the numbers. I don't know if the number of hurricanes is going to increase or not. And then you combine that with, you know, with slow sea level rise. And so that's going to impact a lot of coastal areas in places like Florida, or, you know, places like Bangladesh, where there's a lot of people living at, you know, very close to sea level.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the sort of the microplastics of it all, is there something about microplastics that sort of they're sort of toxin sponges, kind of like they absorb toxins? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. And we have a group here at Woods Hole that works on that. So when, you know, when plastics are manufactured, there's a lot of additives that can be introduced, you know, and it might make the plastic softer or harder or give it some color or make it more resistant to UV rays. And there's a huge variety of additives, something like 10,000 that can go into plastics. And about a third of those are associated with some sort of health concern too. So if a plastic, so right from the manufacturing point, you know, there are additives that that could potentially leach out, like if it got into the, if the plastic got into the tissue of a fish or something like that, it might make its way out. But as you say, there's also some evidence that plastics can kind of attract toxins that are already in the environment. And then the same thing can happen. And, you know, that plastic gets ingested by an organism, a fish or something like that. And then that might be harmful to the fish. But I think, you know, we're kind of scratching the surface of these health risks right now. Some of the studies are very worrisome, but there's a lot of research that we still need to do.
Right. But at the end of the day, there's so much plastic in the ocean essentially right now that it's in all of our water, and therefore it's in the air as well. And it's gotten into our bloodstream. It's gotten into our brains have plastic in them. It's in all of our bodies. And is there anything people can do can they put a water filter in? Is there something they can do for their individual water intake to help in the near term while, you know, hopefully science catches up with getting these microplastics out of the water system?
Yeah. So I don't know what's out there in terms of water filters. You know, certainly the filters that are in everyday use are going to filter out the larger microplastics. But the really small ones, which are the ones we know less about and the ones we kind of worry the most about, might not get filtered out. So, you know, are there developments in industry right now to try to make filters that can get out the very smallest ones? I'm not sure. That's a good question. But yeah, the best thing to do is to get them right at the source, right? Mm-hmm. Not wait till they're in your river or end up in your ocean where it's really hard to filter them out.
Yeah, and the source, I mean, it's a very small percentage of plastic that actually ends up getting recycled. You know, you see the sort of recycling label on a plastic bottle. I think only 3% of plastic in the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. But if you want to listen to my full Cripescast, check out the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down. Just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin. The Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No. Got to keep her moving.
Finally, a voice for real news and great conversation in the Fox Valley, WISS.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, are you exhausted, tired, fed up? We get it, but we want you to get involved. Luann Bird is going to join us to talk about ways to keep going. Don't miss it.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
Get ready, as winter is heating up at Thrasher Opera House in Green Lake with an electrifying lineup of live music. Arkansas brings high-energy bluegrass with a twist on February 21st. The Sweet Lilies deliver their signature soulful harmonies on February 28th with special guests Adrian and Meredith playing folk punk fun. Soul blues rock powerhouse Jesse Roper comes in with a bang on March 1st. Tickets are selling fast. Grab yours now at ThrasherOperaHouse.com. Thrasher Opera House, a cool little historic venue in downtown Green Lake.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic. This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Hamas militants releasing three more hostages, including an American, as part of the ceasefire agreement. ABC's Marcus Moore in Tel Aviv says in return,
Israel released more than 350 Palestinian prisoners. We understand that this includes about 30 who were serving life sentences, but then more than 300 of those who were released from prison are people who were detained in Gaza after October 7th, and they were held in prison since that time.
ABC News has learned about 15,000 IRS employees have been identified for a possible termination as early as next week as the White House seeks to find cost savings across the government. A federal judge issuing a temporary restraining order, in effect holding off on the mass firing of Consumer Financial Protection Bureau employees until March 3rd. Employees could still be fired individually for cause. This is ABC News.